Welcome to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks. I'm Stephanie Fruin, and this is part four of fantasy writer Helen Lowe's tale. We ended part three discussing her fourth book in her Wall of Night series. In part one, we looked at some of Helen's poetry, part two, her first published book, Thornspell, and part three was largely about her first book in the Wall of Night series, The Air of Night. If you haven't listened to them, I highly recommend you do. A reminder that this conversation was recorded in a meeting room at a public library during a very loud storm, so yes, you will hear people moving around and talking, along with the wind and rain against the windows. You will also hear an odd rubbing sound, which is coming from a leather jacket. It's too chilly to remove it. In the final stages of our discussion, we talk about the complexities of realising large fantastical worlds in a written form, crossing multiple stories and characters, and Helen shares her passion for ensuring she gets it right for her readers. She talks about the influence of other writers, Tolkien, as mentioned throughout our discussion, and in this part, Ursula Le Guin. She constantly leaves me in awe of her ability to weave such stories, and I'm sure after listening to Helen, you too will be left keen to read the final part of her Wall of Night series.
4.5 or 5
threads
of things going on simultaneously in this sort of final showdown.
Yeah. Are you, I mean, I consider when I do my writing, I mean, I just have drawings. I'm not a drawer, I'm not an artist at all, but I have to map things out all the time to keep track. Storylines, characters, all this kind of thing.
I make a lot of notes. Yeah. I make a lot of notes. I do, when people are, sometimes I do map things out, especially in Gathering of the Lost in particular, when they were moving a lot. And so it would be like, well, if they were here then and they get there at this time, how much time do they need? How fast can a horse travel in a day? How fast can a person on foot travel in a day? You know, those things. And then there's other things, like, so Malian can open portals, but not many people can. And that was really important, because if everyone could open a portal, then no one would ever go anywhere on foot or ride a horse. So that affects your whole story. And so in the story I'm writing at the moment, no spoiler, but I am moving armies. And so I was thinking, if this army needs to get from here to here within this time period, I was going, and I have them coming over land and blah-de-blah, and I kind of go, nah, they're going to have to go by sea. There's absolutely no way, no way they can get there going over land. And so you have to
And then you've got to think about the ship.
Fortunately, there are ships. We know there's ships from Daughter of Blood, and that there's quite a big maritime industry, and that there's various ports. So that is not such a big difficulty, because that's been established. But, you know, and that the in amongst the Rye Alliance, there's a, the Sea House, and they have a whole fleet. A navy, basically. So, you know, so a maritime fleet, I'm sorry, a mercantile fleet and a military fleet. So, you know, so the logistics of the voyage by sea are not that great. And the infrastructure's already there. But it was just the timing. And timing is can be really critical, even in short events close together. But it's just like, if our hero or heroine has to run or open a portal or whatever, in such and such a time space, can they get from here to here in time? Because if they can't, then I'm going to have to do something else, or they're going to have to do something else. So,
And if you don't get it right, there will be somebody who knows that it's not right. And there's nothing more irritating as a reader, reading something going,
that's not quite right.
You know what I mean? It kind of ruins the whole, everything.
And I really, it really annoys me as a reader. And so I try, really try quite hard to make sure those things aren't there.
And that is why it is not a two, you know, a 2 month or whatever writing process. It's because this takes a long time.
And and unfortunately, like, it sounds funny. There's a poet here in Christchurch called Bernadette Hall.
Hall,
glass, and in the glass jug, I think it is, there's a poem called Angel Fish.
Uh-huh.
And she quotes Edelman, Gerard Edelman, who was a, I think he was a neurobiologist or neuropsychologist or something. I think biology, got a Nobel Prize. But anyway, he's talking about the brain. The quote, I can't remember, I'm not word perfect on the quote. I love the poem, I love the quote. But he says that the brain is not at all like a computer. It's more like a rainforest. You know, there's all this sort of selection and things going on.
Yeah.
And I only know one psychiatrist, but when I made that, mentioned that, he said, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah. That's absolutely right. The brain isn't anything like a computer. But aside from that, and I think, so often when I'm writing, I think I would love my writing to be like a computer. Or I would love to be in a Maserati on a superhighway, you know, just going zoom from beginning to end. But my process is far more like trying to find your way through that rainforest. And you can see El Dorado, but you have to take a lot of false paths to get there. And there are like jaguars and, you know, anacondas and, you know, things to be negotiated. And so when I'm being really amusing, I liked, or I think it's amusing, like to say that my muse is very similar to a donkey in a rainforest. Because if it thinks the author is on the wrong track, the muse just refuses to move forward. So I have to go back and find what the problem is in the writing. So if I'm being more scientific, I will say that my subconscious mind has comprehended something in the story that just isn't going to work. It's going to take me completely down the wrong path. But I have to to go back until I can, the conscious mind can pinpoint what that problem is. And it's always something to do with, like, the writing may be perfectly fine in that place, but it's where it's going to take you. That is, and so I, you know, so I do sometimes feel quite tired thinking about the amount of time I have to backcast and, you know, look for those, you know, things.
But worth it, though.
Well, I hope so. You know, that's all you can do is hope that for the reader, well, for me to feel like I've done my very best to give the reader an experience that's seamless. So these things I talk about, like continuity and time, the reader shouldn't have to think about them.
No.
They should be invisible to the reader. All the reader, to me, the reader, it's about them enjoying the narrative, the action of the story, the depth of the characters. You know, if they are, you know, cheering for some characters and booing others, and, you know. So one of my early moments where I felt as a writer, you know, I think I might be on the right track, was an early reader who was a writer himself of Air. Said, I love the story. Love the characters, he said, except for that Earl. He's such an anal retentive bastard.
Brilliant.
And I went,
yes, thank you.
Because that's exactly what he is.
Yeah,
he's not a bad man,
no,
but he is very anal retentive. And
isn't that funny?
Yeah.
And it's great. Went, you know, perfect. I could have had a better review. Thank you.
Yeah, I actually thought that was, you know, I thought my work here is done.
Yes.
Because I found him very hard to write.
Yes.
Because that thing of him not being a bad person, he's not a bad man, but he's not a sympathetic person either. And so I actually spent a lot of time just sort of writing, handwriting notes about who he was and why he was the way he was, and just so that it flowed.
And when you did Air of Night, did you have in your head the stories, the future stories, or did you complete that and then it was like, I think I've got another... there's another part to the story that I need to write. Like, or was it...
No, it was always one story. Always one story. My inexperience was not understanding that it wasn't a standalone book. You know? And then... So I started off writing it, and that was my... it was going to be a standalone book.
Yes.
And then... and it was the first book I'd written. And then I thought, you know, I think maybe it's a trilogy. And then... well, it's just traditional for fantasy.
Yes.
But, and then there was interest in publishing it, they wanted to know exactly how many books they were signing up for. So that's, I sat down and really plotted it out, and I thought, no, it's definitely four.
Interesting.
It's a huge, huge story. And I have learnt things along the way. So this only has one point of view character.
So Thornspell has one point of view character. This does
the
not.
The Air of Night has more like 15 through the three books to date.
Right.
You know, and I've tried really hard not to add any more in the final book.
Yeah.
Because what I have learned is that the more point of view characters you have, the bigger your book will be.
Goodness me.
Because each character, you have to go into their head. Each one has to have their own backstory and, you know, and their own path through the story, even if it's small. Some of them are small parts, but you still have to kind of make sure that their path is...
I'm in awe of the fantasy writer, I have to say, because to me it requires a lot... Say, for example, if I'm comparing your book, The Air of Night, say, to a modern-day story, I won't say a white name, but I'm just trying to think of, you know, something like a modern-day story set in an old people's home and they solve a mystery.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. I love those stories.
So do I, because they're so easy to read. I don't have to think
about
them.
Thursday Murder Club.
Thank you. I was going to say, okay. Richard Osman.
Just a little ad for Richard Osman.
Yeah, Richard, great book. I actually
Doesn't need it, but exactly.
I really enjoy them. And in fact, I'm reading another book at the moment, not by him, but it's one that's really similar, and it's called The Trust. And it's a similar thing. And I read it, and they're easy. I can turn off. I'm just given everything. It's just fed to me. I don't have to think about it. Whereas when I read your work, not your short stories, not your poetry, but your fantasy fiction, I have to fully engage.
Right.
And that's just the way my brain works. I would imagine there'll be other people who pick it up and they don't, maybe that to them it's like Richard Osman, you know what I mean? But it's because you have these worlds which are so elaborate in description and people and place and time and everything. And I just have, I'm in awe of the fantasy writer because you give such amazing detail. And maybe that's because it's not the world that we live in, so you can't just simply say she picked up her whatever, and it's something that we have every day. You actually have to give the description because otherwise we would go, well, what does she mean?
Well, that's what Ursula Le Guin said.
Ursula K. Le Guin was a writer of science fiction and fantasy novels, short stories as well as criticism, poetry, children's books and essays. She is well known for the books of Earthsea series and the Heinisch Cycle and her acclaimed story collection, The Wind's 12 Quarters. She was a feminist philosopher and environmentalist, and Shreya Chattopadhyay of the New York Times says of Le Guin, her powerful imagination turned hypothetical elsewhere into vivid worlds governed by forces of nature, technology, gender, race and class, a far cry from our own.
What Ursula Le Guin said. I mean, I try only to describe things that matter.
Yes.
But there's a lot that matters. But Ursula Le Guin said that is the essential difference between, she was talking about speculative fiction, science fiction and fantasy. Yes. That is the essential difference, that in this world, even with Harry Potter, when they talk about, is it Liverpool Station? Which is the station that they go to get the... I can't remember.
One and three quarters.
See, it's platform 13 and three quarters or nine and three quarters or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's a real train station.
Victoria.
I don't think it is Liverpool.
I think it's Victoria Street, isn't it?
I don't know.
Oh, no, it's King Cross.
King's Cross, that's right. Okay, so it's a real station and people will have some knowledge of that. They can go to the station.
Yes.
Yeah. So... yeah, so I think that there's a certain element of that, and the Muggle world is our world, and then you have Hogwarts, which is the magical part. But I think when you're writing an alternate world fantasy, everything, you can't assume that people know anything except what you tell them, and you can imply stuff. So doing that, well, what Ursula Le Guin says is it's doing that without the info dump, and that is the that's the challenge.
Definitely. So out of all of the characters you have written, all of the places you have created, do you have a favourite?
I don't think I do, you know.
There's not one that you sort of feel more relatable to, or...
No. I love all my characters, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yes.
Sometimes I just love them for their badness. Yes. And... sometimes they challenge me. I'm not sure whether they are good or bad. You know, that can be until I've sort of worked through them. But I don't think I do have a fondness for Asantia, just because of the way she leapt into the story and made me pay attention.
So I love that story. I think that's fabulous.
She's not the only character that's done that, but she was the first. You know, so I kind of I do really love her. And I did found Myr in Daughter of Blood, which you haven't read. She's the main character. Well, she's the Daughter of Blood. It's not Malian. Malian is in the book, and Callan and all the rest of it. But it's really Callan's book. You know, so like there's Malian and Callan. And Daughter of Blood is Callan's book.
Right.
You know, he has more page time than Malian in the book, although her part is still, you know, obviously she has to be there. But Myr is the titular character. And I tried to write her. I found it rewarding to write her because I was deliberately trying to write a different kind of heroine. And what I was trying to achieve is, like, I have lots of strong and kick-ass heroines. Actually, Myr is really strong too, but just in a very different way. So when I taught martial arts, I used to teach women's classes. And a lot of the women who came along, like, they wanted to increase their sort of like physical capability and all the rest of it, and to learn, but they were really diffident about the physical side of it, and they strangely didn't like being hurt. And doing the martial arts, you get very used to having sort of bruises and aches and pains. But I really kind of wanted, you know, I never dismissed those just because I was the instructor or whatever, and a bit of a hurly-burly girl. I never dismissed them because I think they're entitled to be like that, and they shouldn't have to feel like they are in any way lesser just because they don't want to be this kind of person. So I wanted to honour them in a main character in my book. And that character is Myr. So Myr does not like training with weapons and all that. She's not that kind of heroine. She's still a heroine, though. So I'm not going to tell you anymore. I hope you'll read the book and meet Myr. But she's not, like, she's not my favourite, but I, in the sense of, I have a favourite character. But I found it rewarding to write her and to try and work through that whole... whole thing.
Well, I thought one of the, surely I think one of the best reviews that you got for The Heir of Night was, I hope I've written it here, someone said it was like George, what's his name's?
Oh, George R.R. Martin. Yes, someone did. It was one of the American journals.
Yes, they did. They liked
compared it to Georgia.
And I'm thinking, gosh, well, that's great, because anyone who obviously is looking anything up to do with him, well, here you are. You've been likened. You know, so great. So when it comes to your audience, and, you know, do they mainly come from the States? I mean, I also have to comment on how extensive your website is.
Right.
Like, you are busy on that website with your blog and all that kind of stuff. Not every author does that. A lot of authors don't realise that that is a product that requires marketing, and this is your business. And I kind of feel that you've got that, whether you have or not, I don't know, but you've actually, you are engaging with your audience.
I do try and engage with my readers.
Yeah.
Like if a reader writes to me, I always reply.
Yeah.
You know, there's not often a lot you can say, but I try to always acknowledge.
And you are getting a lot of, well, there has been in the past, a lot of notes from people on your blog saying, when can we expect you?
I think they're getting
pressure.
No pressure.
But I think that's wonderful.
I have very good and supportive readers. They're very patient. Do you know, have you picked up that there's Facebook group half? That there is actually a Facebook group set up of to discuss the books.
Clearly you didn't set that up.
No, I did not, no.
How wonderful.
It was set up by readers.
And where are they based, mainly?
Well, actually, I think I'll say UK because the convener is in UK.
Fabulous.
I don't know. I know some...
Yeah.
I have readers from all over the world.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's only one in some countries, but
you know there are there.
Yeah, because people, you know, they do contact me, and so like I know I have readers in India, the Middle East, you know, throughout Europe, in the UK, in America, Africa.
Yes. It strikes me that the fantasy reader collective, for want of a better expression, are very supportive of their writers.
Yes, they can also be very critical of their writers.
I'm sure about that as well, but they're very vocal.
Yes.
The yays or the nays.
You just have to look at the passion about the Tolkien show.
Hugely
and things
passionate.
Like that. Yeah.
And surely things like, you know, the film Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones being put on as a television series has done a huge amount, I would imagine, for the fantasy book industry.
I think you see a lot more fantasy in the media now.
Yeah, you do.
I think that part of that is the great leap forward in special effects, which enable things like dragons and that to be done in a credible way.
Yeah.
It has. I mean, the genre community is really strong.
Yeah.
And I am fortunate to have, I have a readership, don't know whether, I'm sure it overlaps with the genre community, but I'm not convinced from the communications I get that it's solely sourced in that community.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that it's a reader. Yes. I'm also got a reader's readership, if
I just gathered that, but I do think that your website is great. It's really informative and it really connects with those who are interested and passionate about your work, which is so nice to see. And I love that you're keeping them up to date with where you're at.
How can I find a different way to say still writing?
Still writing.
Not finished yet. A bit like there was a meme of when the Lord of the Rings movies came out with Aragorn, you know, Viggo Mortensen as Aragorn going, still not king. Not king yet. And I thought, feel a bit like that about sometimes it's like still writing, not finished yet.
But it's exciting and so when you get to the end of that, in the back of your head, is there anything tapping away going, and then it's my turn?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
definitely.
Look, how wonderful.
Yes, definitely. And I've started, that's how I know I'm getting to the end.
Yes.
I haven't started writing, but I've started thinking of those other stories. They're starting to kind of, and I have another manuscript that I wrote between Thornspell and Gathering of the Lost.
Yes.
But it's sitting, it's waiting for me to go back and go. I just haven't had the time.
It's waiting for its time.
It is waiting for its time.
Yeah.
And one of my beta readers has said she thinks it's the best thing I've ever written. So who knows?
Who knows?
And she's a fan, I hasten to add.
So do you do most of your writing here in Christchurch? Because obviously you've got a home here in Christchurch. Mm. Or down in your lovely little secretive spot?
Yes. I mainly, at the moment, mainly in the hut.
In the hut.
Yeah, that's in Mid Canterbury, the huts.
Yeah.
You know, they're batches north and cribs south of the Waitaki.
That's funny, isn't it?
In Mid Canterbury, the huts.
Yeah. Mm. It's quite right, actually, the hut. My dad used to refer to the batch. We called it the batch, he called it the hut.
Mm.
That's so funny. I've never thought of it like that before. Now, before we wind up, because I know we absolutely have to wind up, but I also just wanted to quickly mention your short story, Red Earth.
Yes.
Which I think is just completely fabulous. Again, so different to Thornspell, Air of the Night, so different to all of that. And that was done in 2008.
Yeah.
If that was published now, I think that's so climate change.
It is a climate change short story.
It's
absolutely a dystopian vision of a climate future.
Absolutely. And just, so what was the background behind that?
I can't remember if there was a particular spur to it, other than my general, you know, the natural world is a big thing, a big influence on my writing. I could see that we were doing nothing about climate change, and I was thinking about how it might or could affect society and what some of the worst case scenarios would be. And so it is a... it tries to give a very human grounding to, it's not so much about the dystopia but about the human the human loss and and I think so. I think if I compared it to something, it, you know, Station 11 by St. John. Yes, Mandel St. John.
I'll look it up.
I think it might be Emily. But anyway, I know it's terrible. I should just have all these names at my fingertip. But Station 11, I think, is a wonderful novel about a dystopian future. It's a post...
I've seen the film. I think I've seen
There's a TV show.
Yeah.
It is Emily St. John Mandel.
Yeah.
But anyway, TV show, and which I thought was, I did not rate at all compared to the book. I thought, and it didn't really capture the spirit of the book.
Yeah.
Because it's not about, I did a review on my blog, because basically it's not really about the, it's about gritty survival and fighting for your life, although, you know, obviously there are, you know, difficult things with people. It's really more about cultural and social survival. So anyway, and so Red Earth is about the same thing. I think, even though I hadn't read Station 11 then, but it's the same kind of story. It's really trying to take a little slice at what a worst case climate scenario is. So it's not an alley, it's not an extinction level event story, but it's definitely an extreme level.
Yeah, I thought it was great, and I think especially for a younger audience, to me this is this would be a perfect short story for our people, for our young people to be studying at school.
Oh, right. Okay. You know, thank you.
To be put as part of their curriculum, because it's quite almost poetical in your writing as well. And I just, it's so relevant today. And I think more and more countries, we're all noticing, aren't we, the effects of climate change. I mean, goodness me.
Well, it's like if you hit someone over a head with a hammer hard enough, and often enough, they may start to pay attention.
That's exactly right. And so, to me, I read this and I thought, oh, here's a story that should be in the English literature curriculum of all schools, really. Makes you think, and it's a great story. You haven't done a collected short stories at all, have you?
No.
There's one for your agent to sort out for you.
Yeah. Except there's no market in short stories.
But
certainly in the way of lyrics for novels and that.
Yeah.
It's just, and there's certainly none for poetry.
No. Do you think your books, are these available as e-books and as audio books?
Yep, they're available, or not audio.
Audio, no.
No, they're not available as audio, but they are available across all the e and print in all the places.
And have
except Thornspell has gone out of print, sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And has anyone given you any suggestion at all about them, you know, adapting them for the screen at all? Or
No, there was screen interest in Thornspell, but there's often interest, but it doesn't necessarily manifest as... as anything. And I think I'm not on the same level as George R. R. Martin for my readership and following. but I am not in that category, no. and my story is not yet finished. Yeah, so yeah. I can see that even if people might see potential, they would go, well, where's this going?
I really, because to me, what I find fascinating at the moment is the rise in the gaming industry.
Yeah.
And to me, the gaming industry has always been kind of fantastical in the era of fantasy writing. And I don't know, I just sort of look at this sort of thing and I think, you know, the gaming industry will have a field day with
it. Someone has said that they want to make a game out of it.
Yeah, fabulous.
But they weren't, I said I couldn't, because the proposal was so non-fleshed out not something I could take to my agent or whatever, just someone saying this would, you know, fair and I'd love to do it and whatever, but there wasn't, and I said I couldn't consider it until I'd finished the series.
Exactly, and then maybe some of your readership can write notes saying, oh, I'd love to have this as a game on my PS2. Well, that's years ago, whatever, you know, PS5, don't you know?
Well, I mean, you only have whatever. To look. I know, it is. Games are huge, and I think you only have to, it's going the other way now, because that TV show, The Last of Us, that's just finished, is based on a game.
On a game.
And a lot of the things that happened in it reflect scenarios in the game.
Yeah, yeah. So. And the genres are crossing over all the time now, aren't they? You know, and just because it's done as a book doesn't mean it can't be anything else.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I have loved talking to you. Thank you so much for enlightening me about the fantasy world.
That's all right. You're welcome.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And it was great. It really was great. Because, you know, like I said, I know nothing about the genre. I really didn't read it at all when I was younger. And the closest thing I got to fantasy was Enid Blyton. You know, I was... Oh, Enid Blyton and, you know, I was a real keen The Lion, The Witch.
Yeah, I was too.
I read all of it. In fact, every couple of years I read the series again. I just have one of those things about it. I think it was time for me to read The Lion, The Witch, The Wardrobe.
Well, it's lovely.
Series.
I love The Lion, The Witch and The Wardrobe. It's definitely very formative as well. Tolkien and Lewis. And then I discovered other people like Ursula Le Guin. I just think... And I almost didn't read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe because I didn't like the cover.
Isn't
I'm a very
funny?
Visual person.
So am I.
Didn't like that grey, that silhouetted grey. My brother had got it out the library and he said, I think you might like this. I was about 7 or 8, you know. And I went, I was kind of very resistant because I didn't like the cover. But then, of course, I started and was totally hooked.
Yeah.
So.
Funny, isn't it? That's funny. But thank you so much.
You've been listening to part 4 of season 2 of The Author's Tale, featuring Helen Lowe, presented and produced by me, Stephanie Fruin. I hope you've enjoyed Helen's tale, and I would like to thank her for her time, sharing with us some of the stories from her writing journey to date. You can find out more about Helen on her website, www.helenlowe.info. The link is in the show notes. Thank you for listening to The Author's Tale. Don't forget to follow to get instant notifications of future episodes. This has been brought to you by Edition Audiobooks and Digital Publishing, helping you bring your books to life. EditionAudiobooks.com.